Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Jane Davis from Hope House. I'm very happy to welcome back to the show now Deborah Tang and Jim Podesta from St. Elizabeth Shelter and Karen Rowell from Youth Shelters, both very important organizations here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. It's nice to be back.
Yeah, it's great to have you. As always, St. Elizabeth Shelter is working with people who are homeless for many reasons, providing food, shelter, and clothing, essentially, and Youth Shelters doing similar things and counseling and so on with young people.
Correct.
We've been probably talking to both of your organizations for the 7 years that I've been doing this show, and in economic uptimes and downtimes, the problems are always there. How are they worse now in the current recession?
So at St. Elizabeth Shelter, we're really seeing a whole lot more families who are homeless and single women. And this past year, we actually opened a new shelter called Casa Familia over on Berry Street, and it's for single women and families. With that new shelter, we've doubled the amount of beds in northern New Mexico, permanent shelter beds. And with that change, we immediately were full and continue to be full with families and single women, especially older women over 40 who are losing a job and not being able to find a new one. And so, usually our folks are able to, especially the skilled older women were able to find another job fairly easily. But in this economic recession, there just aren't that many jobs anymore.
And I think it's important, as you said, skilled people. I mean, we've got middle-class people who are suddenly no longer middle-class,
right.
No longer even homeowners or even renters.
Right, right. And whole families, where both the mother and the father have lost their jobs and are not able to be able to hold it together to maintain housing.
What are you, Karen, seeing with the young people here in Santa Fe?
Well, in our street outreach program, we are seeing a real shift in the population. First of all, we served from last year to this year in street outreach. We usually serve about 500 kids. Last year, we served 667. It used to be that half of those kids were transient and half of them were from Santa Fe. Now, what we're seeing is 80%, 80 to 85% of those kids are now from Santa Fe. And they're not necessarily all homeless, but what they are is they are all in very precarious situations with no food at home or with very fragile infrastructure systems. So maybe they're sleeping on a couch and, those couches aren't available. The other thing we're seeing is that the kids who are in our shelter are staying for much longer periods of time because there is no place for them to go. Long-term residential treatment is closing down. Group homes are closing down. There are fewer foster care or treatment foster care families. And so there's no place for them to move to out of our shelter. And so, unfortunately, our emergency shelter is becoming more of a long-term placement because there's no place for them to go.
Why are all these other institutions shutting down?
Well, therein lies another thing that we're seeing differently is that funding.
Is this the state budget crisis?
It's the state budget crisis. It's the change in the state system. We have fewer resources in New Mexico for services, for human services, and even in the federal budget, that there's been certain cuts in certain programs. You see the changes in Medicaid. You see changes in federal funding to Runaway Homeless Youth Act. And so the infrastructure for providing services is diminishing. The need for those services is increasing. And, kids just are kind of falling through the cracks.
It's such an irony that when times are rough, that's when you need services
totally.
The most.
Totally. And, you know, the thing is going to what Deborah was saying about families are homeless, is that oftentimes when in the economic situation that we're in right now, the stress on the family is so tremendous that you see more kids being thrown out, being locked out, the family system just breaking down.
Families being locked out of their
no kids
own,
being locked I mean, out of
kids
their
being
houses
locked out of their parents' uh-huh. houses.
Yes, kids being thrown out of their parents' houses. The stress level is so high that or kids run away because of increased abuse or neglect, and so there's more kids for us to serve.
So, to what extent, I mean, when times are rough, I would think substance abuse also increases, making all of these problems that much worse.
Absolutely. I think what Karen was saying about the stress of the family, there's more substance abuse with frustration and maybe more domestic violence, more
yes.
Child violence. So.
And then you have food instability. I mean, we keep hearing a lot this season from the Food Depot. So you have food instability as well, and all those things just increase the stress level in a family, and then the system starts to fall apart because there aren't enough supports.
Jim, what are some of the stories and things that you've been seeing among the people who come into St. Elizabeth's Shelter?
Well, to second what Deborah said, one of the things we really noticed and one of the things that really surprised me was since opening Casa Familia last November and this year, so I say in this year we've had about 300 women and children in Casa Familia, and of that number, more than 50 of those women have been aged 45 and older, which really surprised me. And from the program manager who runs the shelter, basically they've all had jobs most of their lives, and these are people who, like me, have never been homeless before and are really confused. And, you know, they're just not your there's not what some people think of the stereotype of the permanent homeless people. These are people who have had jobs, and because of this recession, they've lost them. And perhaps they're seeing now, you know, it's difficult to get a job, and particularly if you're older, there might be some semblance of age discrimination is going on. So we're really fortunate that we've started this Casa Familia program because it gives them a place that they can go, they can stay, they can get food, they can get shelter, and we have professional staff there that can help guide them on this, you know, on how to access other services, how to go about trying to find jobs, how to go about addressing a healthcare need. You know, in our society, we base the healthcare system on your employment. You lose your job, you lose your healthcare.
Right.
And
another
right.
situation of when you
yes.
need it most is when it's least there, given our system. I think it's important to talk about. I mean, there are people who have major problems, who grew up in messed up households and who need counseling in order to get on the right track and so on. And those are people who can be helped and pull themselves up and so on. But then beyond that, there is just a great big elephant in the middle of the table, which is a structural problem of the shrinking, disappearing middle class and the lack of social safety net and services in the United States and
right.
in New Mexico.
Right. Yes. So one of the examples that we have is somebody who was a massage therapist, and it just seems like everything kind of constricted, and just like you were saying about the middle class disappearing, there's less and less people that are able to afford something like a massage, and so her business suffered, and she didn't have any kind of medical coverage or anything because of the being a sole
being self-employed,
right? And so then she's got a major illness, and she's just in really bad shape, and came to us. Luckily, though, she was able to get back on her feet and find some other work, and so she's doing good.
Yeah, we have another. Actually, we're majoring lately in massage therapists who've lost their job, because we had another one who was actually a younger woman in her 30s, but she was working with she's part of a consortium in a self-employed people, but all sharing an office space, and her client list went down. She ended up getting behind her rent. She lost her housing. She started sleeping at the office. You know, after a while, that's not cutting it. So she basically ended up at our Casa Familia. And actually, we were fortunate that the stimulus program really helped, because there were these homeless, the HPRP program, which was funds designated for rapid rehousing, homeless prevention and rapid rehousing. And through that, we've accessed some of those funds. for Northern New Mexico, and we have a case manager who worked on that, and he basically could use some of that funding to put down the deposit and get her, you know, she's in an apartment of her own now, that she's got 3 months of secure funding while she can try to rebuild her client base and hopefully get going. But without that, she would still either be in Casa Familia or, you know, back in her office space, sleeping on her massage table, I guess.
So I like to also talk about, you know, what happens with kids is in our system, you know, they go without medical care, and then they end up very sick, or they need, you know, eye exams, or they need dental care, and because we don't really have much of, you know, a safety net beyond Medicaid, you know, many kids who are living out on the street, or who come into our services through a variety of doors, have no health care. They have no way to get food. You know, so many times they're still attached to their parents, and then their parents are not available, and so they can't move ahead to get medical care, to get, you know, Social Security cards, identification. We help them with all those things, but it can sometimes be a really long, drawn-out process. So in a time when those things are so important in terms of being a safety net, they're so complicated to come by. You know, one other thing I would just like to say also is, you know, with young people, one of the ways that we help them change their circumstances is by being able to go to school and being able to get a job. And so in this time of economic loss of jobs, you know, they are the last ones to be able to get a job. They're the most unprepared for work. They have the fewest skills. And so even those jobs that, you know, a year or two ago where they could go to McDonald's or go bag something, you know, go in the grocery stores, you know, adults are getting those jobs now. So kids are not able to get a stable place to live. You know, even when some of our kids get the HPRP funds that Jim was talking about, you have to be able to hold on to your housing by getting a job.
Right.
And when you can't get a job, then you can't hold on to your housing, and then you just cycle all the way back through.
Right. What are some of the, tell us about, without giving names or confidential information, tell us about some of your actual young people.
Well, you know, that in the face of all this challenge is the most rewarding part of doing this work, is how resilient these kids are. So we will have a young person come to street outreach who maybe has been camping out or living out on the streets and starts coming to our street outreach program where we give them food, we help them, you know, they can take a shower, kind of get stabilized. And then, you know, they'll keep coming back on, they'll say, oh, could you help me get into school, or could you help me get a job? And they actually respond to that support by making some changes in their lives. So we had a young person last year who came to us who, you know, realized that he wanted to go to school. He went through the Santa Fe Community Foundation, this program we have for gay, lesbians, bisexual, transgendered youth. And he got a scholarship to the community college. Now he is working, and he is on a career path. He has a safe, you know, and stable place to live. You know, really by coming and starting to have a relationship with youth shelters. We have kids who are living in our transitional living program who have gotten off the streets, who are going to the community college, who have gotten their GEDs, and through a lot of determination are finally, you know, finding some very, very part-time jobs. But again, they're completing their education, you know, and they're going on to lead, you know, independent lives.
It's such a tricky moment that we're in because, I mean, I know young people, very well educated, yes, master's degrees and
yes,
so on,
exactly,
who've been looking for jobs for a
yes,
long time.
It's very tricky.
I mean, this idea that education is the golden ticket.
No.
It's
no,
not anymore.
No, and, you know, sometimes I
and yet
know,
you can't, there's not an alternative either.
No. Except sometimes if you can if you know somebody who knows somebody, or somebody might teach a trade, or, you know, say, well, we have a little opening here, and you start out with a little, you know, part-time job, and then maybe it works, and maybe it doesn't. And, you know, it's those safety nets, whether it's at, you know, St. Elizabeth's or youth shelters, that because so many people cannot do it on their own right now.
So, and I agree. I mean, there's a lot of times when things have been tough for my relatives, and they've come to stay with me, and, you know, there's been that kind of, you know, there's somebody
support system
who can support you. But if you don't have that support system, you're really in trouble.
And I would say that, you know, that's one of the, I think, as providers of services to people who are homeless, whether they're adults or whether they're youth, is that that's what we are, us service providers are trying to extend, is a helping hand, is a bridge that, you know, for us, we serve so many kids who do not have family connections. And so we try and be that connection until they have an experience, enough of an experience of success, small as...
Right. And then you all three of you here and many others who work in these two institutions and others in Santa Fe as well, are put in the position of being family, of loving these young people who you are just getting to know or these older people who you're just getting to know. And the line between real personal, heartfelt relationships and professional relationships, I would think by necessity gets blurred.
And you have to be extremely careful.
Yeah.
And also, I think, you know, ethically, you have to be careful, but I think also that what we're really doing is a hand up, not a hand out. And so people also have to be able to meet you so you're not doing all of it for them, that they're
right.
Finding their way as well. Wouldn't you
yeah,
say that?
Yeah. And I think that you also have to be careful that some people you may not like, but they need your services just the same.
Absolutely.
So you have to, you know, really learn to not take a step back, but make sure that there is that professionalism mm-hmm. there so that mm-hmm. everybody gets the help they need.
There's a great Martin Luther King speech in which he talks about loving people but not necessarily liking them all.
Yes, right. Yes. Just like when sometimes with our own teenage kids, we can not like them, but we love them. You know, we have to separate the behavior from the person and hang in there with them.
I think one of the things that must be very hard for people is the sense in which Santa Fe and so many other places in the United States have become kind of third world countries in terms of wealth disparity. You have a very wealthy class, and then you've got everybody else, and beholding people being able to drive fancy cars mm-hmm. and buy expensive food and go to restaurants who don't even notice that everybody else is there and struggling.
You know, and that's what I appreciate when I was driving over here today, is that, you know, homelessness is not just a Christmas season event but at least at this time of year when I think people are more open to giving and extending generosity, that it's so important to be reminded of the disparity. And the fact is that, you know, Santa Fe has a lot of homeless youth, a lot of homeless adults, and that we have to remember them all year round because they're here, whether it's winter, spring, or summer, and that it's more than just thinking of them one time a year. It's really about structure of our society, structure of our community, and you know, creating opportunities and a system where it's not such a discrepancy between those who have and those who have not.
Well, I think Deborah can even address this, because I mean, I think one of the maybe myths out there is shelters are often just warehouses of people, but I think at St. Elizabeth, when we'll let Deborah talk about this, you know, we do have success.
Right. Our whole goal is not to house people. It really is to help them get back on their feet, to get their lives together, and to be independent mm-hmm. as much as possible. And I think that the stereotype of, you know, the drunk on the street as being who is homeless, a lot of times those people who are drunk on the street are not homeless. And a lot of the people that you would not think are homeless, actually a mom with three kids at the Walmart, is actually homeless. So it's I think we're starting to realize that those stereotypes are changing. And, I mean, when we talk about kids, in Santa Fe, who knew that over 1,000 of the kids are registered with the Adelante Public School Homeless Public School Program as being homeless? I think Santa Feans just don't realize that,
I agree.
That there are so many families and children in peril.
And that's what's so important about a program like this, is that we get to have this opportunity periodically to inform and to remind people that we do have homeless people in Santa Fe, that we do appreciate the outpouring from the community, because that's how we are able to do our work, is by having community support, because there is a large population. I mean, last year we served over 1,000 youth and their families who are in some kind of dire situation in terms of their housing and their family connections.
Yeah, and St. Elizabeth served more than 3,000 last year. And like Karen said, 2/3 of our operating budget comes from charitable contributions.
Yeah.
You know, we get about 30% from government, about 60-some percent from charity, and then we have a little else. But so that's the real driver of our income and keeping our programs alive.
And we rely on that funding. Well, the individual donations between now and New Year's keep us going 8-9 months into next year. So it's really important.
And there's a success story, too, is we never want to forget what this community can produce in terms of giving. We've been accepting donations all morning, and you know, people are so responsive. And I do think it comes from these public opportunities to remind people and to educate people about how many families and individuals and youth there are in our community who have little or nothing.
Now, people can come and cook and donate food. I mean, that's an easy thing that that they can do. And I know people in church groups do that all
right,
the time.
Absolutely.
So our emergency shelter on Allred, we don't make any dinners. They're all provided by church groups, civic groups, school groups, all kinds of you and a couple friends can
friend groups,
can be a group.
Yeah.
And so 365 days a year, we have those dinners taken care of. But our new program for women and families, Casa Familia, we're trying to build that same thing. So we're looking for people to once a month, the third Thursday of the month, bring a meal for about 40 people.
Now, when that happens, you've got a group coming in. Do they then make connections and break bread with the?
They absolutely. We encourage them to stay. They do stay. They have great interactions with the families and the single women. Absolutely.
What about youth shelters?
Well, we have volunteers who come in and do special projects in the shelter, who bring food or meals to street outreach. We have someone at the shelter who actually cooks with the kids and teaches them how to prepare meals, and we're looking for someone to do that at our transitional living program. We're starting a GED program where we will take some literacy volunteers to help us with young people and their school challenges. People work in the office. People bring food. They bring donations. Really what we try to do is match a person's interest with something that's in our programs. And we have a wish list always on our website, youthshelters.org. And you can go to our website. You can find out about our programs and also just the kind of items that we're looking for. And or you can call us at area code 505-983-0586 and talk to our volunteer coordinator or our development office.
And same with St. Elizabeth's. We have a newsletter that has our wish list. Jim, is it on the website?
That is a good question. I'm not sure.
Yeah, but
I
that website being stesheelter.org.
Yes, S-T-E.
That's right. Stesheelter.org.
Right. And our phone number, if you want to volunteer or donate, is 982-6611.
Well, one of the big things we have going now is We opened this Casa Familia last November, November of 2009, as Deborah said, and it's got an operating budget of about $250,000, $250,000, and that's been a real challenge to raise that in this current environment. We increased our budget of the overall organization by 20% to do this. So we've been fortunate, though. We had three donors, separate donors, coming who've come forward to make challenge gifts, which all together total $100,000. So we have a combined $100,000 challenge out there.
Excellent.
And if we can raise $100,000 from other donors by the end of the year, we will secure that $100,000, which makes $200,000, which is basically we will cover
You're
the operating
there.
Budget for the year. Yeah. So, and people can do that either by sending in a check to our 804 Alaric Street. They can call us at the number Deborah said, 982-6611, or they can go to the website.
Deborah Tang is Executive Director of St. Elizabeth's Shelter. Jim Podesta is also with St. East. And Youth Shelter's Executive Director is Karen Rowell. Thank you all so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you,
Mary Charlotte.
Thank you
Wonderful.
So much.
And I will link to, on my website, santafe.radiocafe.org, I will link to your website for today's show.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm delighted now to welcome back to the program Jane Davis. She is the founder and executive director of Hope House. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. It's great to be back. It's been a while.
It's been a while. So for those listeners who don't know you and don't know Hope House, just give us a brief overview of what this unusual organization does.
We are an all-volunteer organization. We've actually existed since 1993, so we just celebrated 18 years. We're a nonprofit. And we're really very grassroots and have remained so all this time. And
which is a feat in and of itself, I have to say.
It really is. So our focus, even though we really welcome donations and financial support, I personally have put all of my money into it and welcome any of the support we get. But we do programs in communities, Atlanta and here. And Atlanta is where I founded Hope House and where we began after I witnessed an electric chair execution as media. And I never wrote about it. Instead, I had this vision called Hope House. It's an acronym. And it's about being of service to others. It's about being honest, facing oneself. So it's really about accountability, honesty, faith, because you can't go that deep into oneself without faith in something. And the hand of the logo is action and service. So it's kind of a spiritual action on a daily basis to be aware of everything around you and how can you respond to it in a positive way.
It's an unusual organization in the sense that, we just talked to people from youth shelters and St. Elizabeth's Shelter, and they have a very clear mission, and the animal shelter shelters animals. You do service with a capital S, but it can be anything. You do prison outreach, you take in animals, you work with young people who've lost their way. Basically, kind of this organic whatever comes along, if you're there to serve, then you serve.
Exactly. And so I think it's oftentimes confusing for people to understand what it is Hope House does because of that. And I always say we're of service. And our motto is one heart. And what that means is we're all connected. And so we do a lot of work in the prisons. That started just so we wouldn't forget anybody, but we also work with victims. We're not issue, and we're not government, related.
And you're not politicized.
We're not political at all. So even though I have walked 12 men through their executions, have witnessed electric chair, as well as lethal.
You've witnessed 12. I thought it was just that one
life. That changed my life. But then I've become a spiritual advisor to many in prison and death row. So I have been asked 12 times to go that walk. And that walk has also encompassed doing mediation with victims' family members. And so it's about healing. Hope House is really about healing. And one of the things that we've really been developing, One Heart Ranch, I bought 30 acres of land that we leased to Hope House, and we have people come out. The land is the healer, and so we've had retreats. We've had people, I love sitting down and reading our guest book, because people from all over the world have found their way there. And we have a three-tiered bonfire pit and a little house right now with a solar. It's all, you know, green and it's sustainable. And our hope is to work with, we merge community with people coming out of prison as well, so that we have a model that's, again, very grassroots, where we can help people coming out of prison to get jobs. And we're not
Which
a halfway
house.
Which
is really, really hard. I mean, you can't even get a job at Walmart if you come out of prison, because all of the chain stores have that question about, have you ever been convicted of a felony?
Right.
I mean, there's no backup.
It's very hard. And one of the things we do is we will work with registered sex offenders, which a lot of people go, but we work with human beings from all walks of life. And So it's about healing and about the connected. And I also want to, again, say it's about accountability. So we all have to be accountable. The degree is different. But if we think of spiritual teachings and principles, we think about forgiveness. How does one forgive? And so forth. And that's why we do a lot of mediation. And we show up for people. You know, it's about showing up.
I asked you once about prisoners and forgiveness, and you gave me a very surprising answer, which was that the greatest act of forgiveness that you see is not victims, families forgiving prisoners, but prisoners forgiving their own families that abused them.
That's a big part. That's a very big part of the process. And so, you know, one of the things I'm always curious about, the human mind and human nature, and, you know, how did someone end up at this point? And if you think, you know, obviously we're all born innocent, beautiful children, then life happens and we end up. So that's where accountability is important. So understanding is not an excuse for behavior. So if one commits certain crimes, then one has to pay the time and do the time. But we can understand, and most people are rejoining society. So even though we're not focused on that as a goal, I think that we do affect change, and we have affected lower recidivism rates as a result of our model, which is about human dignity and respect regardless of what one has done. Now, if somebody is a true psychopath, it's different. It's much harder to deal with someone who's a psychopath and expect or affect change. So
I would imagine those are the people with the highest recidivism rate.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and so there's, it's such a complex human, let's just say human nature is so complex. And I think that if society could focus more on that whole issue of forgiveness, it's not society's place to forgive someone who did something to someone else, but I think if we embedded ourselves with more practice of forgiveness on individual paths, then our justice system would be kinder and gentler.
We're talking to Jane Davis of Hope House. Let's go back to this ranch that you, this piece of land that you bought. You said a moment ago the land itself is a healer, and I was thinking about something that I read in your little biography that's on your website, which I didn't know, which is that you used to work with wild animals.
I did. I went to college and graduate school at Washington University in St. Louis and had the good fortune to work for Dr. Michael Fox, who was one of the original bioethicists and animal psychologists who started doing work with wolves in this country. He had the first wolf sanctuary outside of St. Louis. And I got hired by him to be his teaching assistant. And part of that was working with the wolves and coyotes and coy dogs, where he would breed coyotes and beagles. And
really?
Yes. So I had to go take these little wild animals and walk them in the quad when class was in session. And the way I would catch them was I had to become the dominant, you know, the leader
the
of
alpha.
The pack. I was quite the alpha. And one day one of the dogs ran into a large, you know, it was one of these big you know, 101 classes where they're like 300 freshmen.
Right.
And I was chasing this little coy dog around, growling until I was so dominant that she rolled over on her back and I caught her. But to this day, some people still remind me of that incident. But
yes, the freshman whose formative experience was this growling lady.
Yeah. And Dr. Fox actually was one of the first members of our board of directors. And he's now retired, but he went on to be senior vice president of the Humane Society of America. And so he always was still kind of involved. The whole concept of animals, also combining animals with humans and healing. We have two therapy dogs, Hogan and Magic, who you've met. Magic being the little wild one, and Hogan being like a bodhisattva who stares at the moon and communes with the stars. And we've expanded our work community service-wise to the Kingston Residents Memory Care. And in that, we have a volunteer, Dana, who brings her dog Shadows, this large, I forget what kind it is, it's big. And so she brings Shadow into Kingston Residence.
What's Kingston Residence?
Kingston Residence is an assisted living facility in Santa Fe, and it has a separate memory care for people with dementia and Alzheimer's. And so one of our programs in the prison is that we've been bringing in music. And, you know, I just can't praise the local musicians enough. And all of you local musicians who are listening, thank you. We bring monthly concerts into the prison. We were cut back to quarterly, but I think we're now back to monthly. And so a lot of the musicians are starting to also donate their time and come into the residence, Kingston Residence. So again, that's part of, you know, we're not about prison issues, prison reform. We're about community service. And that, I think it's a level below volunteering, because we're not just about volunteering. We really want to infuse people to, on a daily basis, to be aware. How can you be of service? Like, with whatever comes into your sphere. So, you know, that's why we don't have blinders on with a particular thing that we do, because, as you said, it's service with a capital S. And it could be you walk out of the movie theater and there are kids sitting on the floor and you notice one is troubled. I mean, these are real, actually.
Did you do that?
Yes.
What
and
happened?
To this day, well, oh my goodness, about 6 years ago, and I was in DeVargas Mall with friends going out for dinner, and we walked out heading for dinner, and there were three or four kids sitting on the floor. And one of them stood out, and he just, I don't know if he didn't fit, but that intuitive voice said there's something. So I sat down with him. And
was he surprised?
Kind of, but we talked, and then I looked in his eyes, and I said, listen, here's my number. All I can tell you is I really do care about you. I care about our community. If ever you want some support or you just want to talk, here's my number. But it's also, it's not my place. I can't fix anyone, but I can reach out. And about 2 weeks later, he called, and he was 15. He had dropped out of school. He was having issues. So I actually really did get involved with him, and today he's a great member of our community.
And what did you do? What was your interaction with him like?
I use this term a lot, showing up, but I was present for him. He was having some issues with his father, and I offered if he wanted me also to speak with his father. So we all got together. I opened my home to him. You know, and that's another thing that I do that not everybody is willing to or maybe can do, but I really have practiced trusting my intuition for so long that I have had, my home is open. My home is open when that intuition tells me I'm okay. Now, that doesn't mean I'm always going to be okay, but that's what leads me.
But your intuition probably, I would think, keeps people away also who you think might be harmful to you.
Correct. Absolutely. I have very strong boundaries. And because I don't have any illusion of, you know, healing the world or fixing this one, that's not present.
I understand how to be of service.
We're talking to Jane Davis of Hope House. Jane, talk more about the process of forgiveness. I mean, with the people who are on death row, you've seen them through the last days of their life and their execution. There's a process of forgiveness and coming to terms that can happen.
You know, thank you, Mary Charlotte, for asking that. There's one, I mean, and here's one of many stories, but one that stands out was a young man on death row in Texas. And when I met him at the request of his parents, who had heard about Hope House and the work I was doing. And when we first met, as a matter of fact, this story is on the website, and it also is written in Chicken Soup for the Prisoner Soul,
right,
which is a very inspiring book, and I have two stories in it. But, you know, one of the first things Larry identified with me as what he wanted to work on before his execution was to do whatever work he could with his family, the victims' families, of healing. Now, one of the catches to that is, by almost in every state, by policy, a perpetrator cannot contact any victim's families because it could stir things up. That request must come from the victims or victims' families. And so actually, in this case, the victims' families also were familiar with my work, so it worked both ways. They actually did contact me. And so I did mediation, and there were, in his case, there were five victims. He had been diagnosed as paranoid schizophrenic as a teenager. His parents could not get help for him because he was never violent. One day, he mass murdered five people. And instead of getting any kind of help, he was sentenced to death and was executed. And he worked really hard. I saw him frequently. I visited Texas Death Row. And I remember the day after he was executed, I was given some of his belongings, and I was given a letter that he had written that he wanted distributed to the family. And let me backtrack that. I would go into death row with the family's words written all over my body because I didn't want to infuse myself or my interpretation to their words.
And you couldn't take in paper?
I couldn't take in paper and pen. I couldn't take in anything. So my body, I wore loose clothing, and I had things written all over my legs and arms of their words so that I could say, this one said this, and some were, you know, you scumbag, rotten hell. Some were, I'm struggling to forgive you, but I forgive you. You know, it was all a whole mix of emotional response to the horror that he had done to their loved ones. And in the letter that he wrote to them all, one of the lines that stood out was he said, to say I'm sorry seems so shallow. So he asked them for forgiveness, and he really said he still struggles trying to understand why he did what he did. And so it's not clear. I will say this, drugs and alcohol were involved, and I find that the majority of crimes committed, drugs and alcohol are a major factor. So, the other major, I think, act of forgiveness that I was part of was actually the very first, was Chris Berger's execution in 93, when I didn't know Chris. He was the only person whose execution I witnessed that I didn't know.
This was the very first one?
The very first one, on December 7th, 1993. And I was very familiar with his file. I was there as a media witness, so I was familiar with his case, with him. I read his medical file. And he had suffered tremendous abuse. I mean, unconscionable from his mother and her boyfriends. And, I mean, including being locked out in the winter for 4 days. She and her boyfriend were going away and locked him outside in the snow. He was 7 years old.
You know, I just have to say, having just talked to the people from youth shelters, we have stories like this going on in Santa Fe right now,
right,
where parents are locking their kids out of the house.
Right.
And here's what happens later in
some
cases.
Isn't this amazing? Yeah. Right. And also she used to lock him in the closet or chain him to the toilet and leave, trying to control him. And so he had convulsions from his brain rattling in his head from such severe beatings. So this child was no longer, quote, normal as we know it. And the week of his execution, his mother was actually present, and I witnessed him forgiving her. And that was very powerful. That was very, very powerful. And then I had worked closely with Henry Lee Lucas in Texas, who was one of our country's notorious serial killers. And Henry has since died in prison of natural causes. But he was also severely abused as a child. And again, I want to emphasize so strongly that when I tell these stories and talk about the abuse, never, ever, ever am I using abuse as an excuse. And I have to reiterate that over and over.
Yeah.
But if we're looking for answers or we want to shift, you know, we want to shift, like you're talking about the kids in the youth shelter here, from that group of abused children comes a lot of our criminals yeah. as adults. Because when someone turns 18, they don't all of a sudden, like, become these wonderful citizens and know-it-all.
Right.
So we have to pay attention.
I think that, I mean, your group, your organization, Hope House, isn't necessarily talking about this, but when I hear you and I hear the other folks we've been talking to today, there are very great gaps in the way that our system works. So, for example, a paranoid schizophrenic not getting treatment because he hasn't been violent yet, and then going and killing people, that's a real flaw in the system. I mean, nobody who has that illness has the free will not to do that. And for that not to be recognized is not the person's problem any more or less than it is society's problem in not dealing. It doesn't have to be that way.
Well, and it's interesting because I don't even know if you know this, but, you know, some people think that Hope House is my job. Hope House is my passion, and as I said earlier, we're all volunteers, including me. I've always had what I call a day job, and so I'm blessed. I actually am employed by the state of New Mexico, and I work for the Human Services Department, Behavioral Health Services Division. So that's where I earn my money, and we address that in behavioral health services. You know, how do we get programs, especially in our frontier and rural state, how do we get them out into the world? And I've been active with compulsive gambling and DWI, all I can tell you is there's such phenomenal people working for the state on these systems and on these issues, and I'm kind of proud to be part of it. And also just my passion is with Hope House, just showing up.
Jane, it's just about time to go, but if people want to get involved in Hope House in one way or another, what should they do?
They can call me at 983-6677. And also we are on Facebook, and the email is jane@hopehouse.org. And that's hopehouse.org. And also, please visit our website. But I encourage you, be in touch. We need volunteers, and we would love to have you. And also, if anyone out there, it's the end of the year, if you feel so that you need a tax deduction, make a charitable contribution to us. Please help us help others.
Jane Davis, thank you so much for being with us, and we'll see you in the new year.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. And by the way, I'm doing a little survey at facebook.com/radiocafe. So check it out. Give your opinions about the Santa Fe Radio Cafe at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.